Blog Talk Radio.
And without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. For God was made manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, and received up into glory. This is our testimony this morning. This is our record of information that's viable, that will not change. And I ask you on this sensational, glorious, and victorious Sunday, February the 15th, 2015, whose report shall you believe? Shall you believe the report of the Lord, which is blameless, which is faultless, is without error, without contempt, that stands over the annals of eternity, that will not altercate, will not change, will forever stand in integrity and equity? Or will you compromise temporal pleasure and accept the record of what mankind has to say, knowing full well that man that is born of woman is of a few days and full of trouble? Will you accept his report, or will you receive the report of the Lord? Because God's report says we are sealed with his spirit. We are sealed unto eternity with his redemption. We are promised a glorious and victorious life upon this earth when we walk in the pathway of obedience. His report says we have true victory over every element in this world. Mankind says you have to do what I say do, the way I say do it, and how I say do it, and more so when I say do it. Mankind is subject to fault, failure, and insubordinacy. So shall you compromise all that God is to receive what man has for you in the here and now? I say no. I will not compromise. I will not bend. I will receive the greatness, the blessings of the Lord and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Selah. For we know that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and them and all they that dwell therein. And then it's a wonderful time to be in the land of the living. It is indeed an exciting time. God is doing some great things in the kingdom of heaven that are translating right here upon the earth. But see, you've got to be in the right place at the right time with the right frame of mind to receive those things. That's right. You've got to be, how about the old saying would say, you got to be there or else be square. And I'm going to tell you something. I want to be at the right place at the right time when God functions his divine favor upon us. He sends down what is called the latter rain. You see, the latter rain is greater than the condensation of the rain before. What does the latter rain do? The latter rain produces. See, the first rain brings forth the irrigation process. This word of knowledge is out there for someone this morning. I don't know where you are. I'm heard on all six continents, have the largest listening audience on the network. But I'm going to just say this to you. See, the first rain saturates enough moisture so that photosynthesis can begin to illuminate or orchestrate when it works in collaboration or cooperation with the sun. It gets the process going. It gets the wheel spinning. It gets the wheel turning. But you see, you must understand at the same time, the latter rain brings down the power to accelerate the growth process to produce so that that crop is meet and measure for the harvesting. So you got to get the latter rain. How do you get the latter rain? By standing in obedience, by standing in truth, by accepting what is right in the eyes of God. Forget the eyes of man. Man's eyesight is limited. His ability is questionable. He is powerless except the power of God abide with him. Now, there's other powers he may resort to, but they're demonic. And he will have his place in that very place in which Satan and all of his angels are going to abide. So you don't want to follow the pathway of darkness when things are not right in your life. You want to walk in the light, the beautiful light. Come where the dewdrops of heaven shine bright. Shine all around us by day and by night. Why? Because Jesus is the light of the world, and he came to enlighten us. He came to teach us. He came to instruct us. God did not have to allow his only begotten Son to become manifest in the flesh, because Christ is God in the flesh. If you don't acknowledge that, you are not worthy of the kingdom of heaven. You can't even get entranceway into the kingdom of heaven. You can't even be into the gateway, which is on the potential path to get to the gate that shows you the way. You've got to acknowledge that he is Lord. He is Lord to the glory of God. And I just love that song when the songwriter said that he is Lord. He is Lord. Every knee must bow and every tongue confess that he, Jesus Christ, is Lord. I love that song. I love that song. And let me tell you something. Many of you saying, well, I don't have a voice like yours to sing. Let me tell you something. When the Spirit of the Lord begins to emanate in your heart and those joy bells, as I used to hear Pastor Ellis, Bishop Ellis, sing back in his youthful days before he made his transition, that the joy bells start ringing in your phone, you can sing anything, and you don't care how it sounds, because you know what? To man's ear, because man's ear doesn't count, but to the very angels of God and the heavenly host, it sounds like sweet, sweet harmony, because God is lifted up. His name is exalted when you sing those songs of Zion. I'm not talking about this new rock and age so-called gospel that they have. God is not glorified in that foolishness, because it's so worldly. You know, the world relates to it, and they play it in various secular venues. That's right, and they dance off of it. I'm talking about the real songs of Zion, of the patriots that went through the process of pleasing God, that went about doing what the Lord said do, that went about their way, lifting up his name. I'm talking about those old songs of Zion that really, really took us back to that old landmark where God would have us to be. And we've got to get the church back to God. It's gone to the world. It's a sad factor to say this as a teacher, this, as a word of knowledge, and just saying we've got to get it back to God, because it has slid into the world to a point that there's no difference. They're dressing like people out there in the wrong type of lifestyle, conducting their affairs like people out there in the world. That's right, are conducting their behaviors. That's right, same hairdos you see on people who say they're Christians. You see the same behavior, the same lifestyle. What is the difference? There is a difference between believers and non-believers. We hold a standard that the world should be coming after. We shouldn't be coming after the world standard, and that is what has translated at this day and at this time. But thank God he has definitely set some of us in heavenly places in him on this earth where we are able to teach and instruct those who are wayward and didn't know that they were wayward, who want to do what's right. And let me tell you something. It's a day and time we got to cut out this foolishness, and let's just be for real. You know, and oftentimes I think of myself in the classroom when I'm dealing with students and I'm telling them, first of all, we've got to cut out this monkey shine. That's right, because why? We're not accomplishing anything. We've got to get our act together. And I kind of put a little law of enforcement down. When I click that ruler on the desk, everybody's eye focuses on me. But until that point, they're so playful and so charismatic. And I do love to see the children have fun, because that's a part of childhood. But there comes a time that you must be instructed. Why? Because you've got to be prepped up for the next step up. When you go out there into that role, you've got to be equipped. And guess what? God holds me accountable as a teacher to equip you. And if I lack in my posture and my position, well, you know something? My credentials will be questionable. That's right. I have the calling. I have the certification. I have the verification. But I have to still implement the process. Why? Because the contingency of my pay, which is my reward, is based upon my standards of performance of excellence. And I'm going to give you the very best, because God has entrusted me with the very best, and we're going to receive the very best together. And let's open up our hearts and our minds this morning and get beyond the mess. And this is what God is calling for us to clean up the mess that we're in. We're talking about spring cleaning. Let's consider this a first segment a spring clean in the church. That's right, in our lives, in our bodies. Because, you know, we are the church. Our bodies are the temple. We are to regard this temple highly and not do it any kind of way, not overeat. Oh, that's right. Many of us talk about old people drink. Well, you know, so being drunk is an infraction. It's not a sin, but it's an infraction. God does not smile upon you because you're trying to use a clause of escape instead of facing reality and say, Lord, my God, help us without me. Okay? So we talk about drunkenness. We talk about people that do other things, you know, that use other substances as escape mechanisms. We talk about them, but we don't want to talk about overeating. Okay, hello. And many of us do that. We commit that morbid act of infraction. Every time we sit down at the table, we're eating all through the day. We're eating all through the night. We get up in the morning, we got a donut. Come on now, let's be realistic. I'm using this as a base level scenario. We don't want to talk about that. You know that eating all the time promotes a behavior. That's right. It's considered a definitive infraction, not only in the spiritual aspect, but in the natural aspect as well, called gluttony. That's a form of greed and disrespect for the very integrity of your body and of others. That's right. And he that defiles the temple of God, him shall God destroy. I mean, God will allow certain things to happen in your body as a result of disobedience. That's right. We're to be moderate and temperate in all things. I don't tell people you're wrong because you drink wine, because Timothy was told by Apostle Paul, we're going to be getting into the book of Timothy, actually the third chapter, talking about the position of those who are in authority, what the qualifications are, because I heard something this week, and we'll talk a little bit about that later, but I want to say this. Apostle Paul told Timothy to drink a little wine for his stomach's sake, for his often infirmity. Did you not know that perhaps Timothy had some degree of indigestion problem that could have been either at what we refer to in this common eye day, because everything that happened in that day did not have a label because it had no specific stable. But see, we have stables and labels today. It's called acid reflux. That's right. And that wine would saturate his stomach to the point he could digest his food, and his drought would come out in a more regular and more formidable fashion. So he was advised to do that. And our Messiah turned water into ceremonial wedding wine. So there's no sin in taking the wine for the rightful reasons, because it's a blood cleanser. That's right, but it's to be taken as a medicine in a moderation form. When you start overly drinking wine, see, wine is a mocker. It makes a fool out of you because the fool was already activated in your character, but it accelerates the process and puts it on front street. I call it full throttle modus operandi, and that is what happens. So we have to understand these things, that at any time we should let them slip. Everything is not a sin, and stop saying this is a sin, that's a sin. No. Stealing is an infraction. We know that that's wrong. That's right. Lying, God said he will not even want a liar in his sight, because a liar is a disrespectful person that's going to try to deceive others so that he or she can get over without going under. A liar is nothing but a verbal murderer. We know how God feels about those people. That's right. Adulterers, that they break their covenants. That's why God doesn't like covenant breakers, because even covenant breaker, you're a talebearer. You're a deceiver. That's right. And he cannot stand deceivers, because Satan, one of the most beautiful angels known as Saint Lucifer in his more elusive existence, was considered the one of the most beautiful angels he met. But he was a deceiver. He had an underlying scheme. He wanted to take over. That's right. And pull everything else under. So God doesn't look at deceivers very favorably. And God doesn't look at those who are disobedient of their own volition very favorably as well. This is the reason why we're here on Manna from on High. We're going to go as according to the way that we are led, because we don't have to give an account to what we say in the eyes of men, but we have to give an account in the eyes of the Lord, and we have to speak the truth. And you know something? Made a lot of enemies, but you know something? They'll get over it, because they'll realize the truth sometimes is a bitter pill to ingest. But guess what? If you ingest that pill, as I've had to do many times, you will experience the very balm of Gilead. You know what that balm of Gilead did? It healed the body, made the body whole from the inside out perspective. That's why things began to take place. the supernatural begin to occur from the standpoint of God's divine intervention. So it's a bitter pill that's going to help us to grow and help us to get on the right path and the right track, because it's spring cleaning time, phase one. We've got to get things back in order. That's right. And look, we're going to the first division of Timothy. There were two letters wrote to Timothy by the second chief apostle in charge, which was Apostle Paul. That's right. At former times, this man was deemed as a tyrant, a terrorist that was proactive in his period, in which so many people were fearful of this man because he had a terrible reputation of closing down numerous congregations, imprisoning believers, causing them to suffer needlessly. And God beat him down on the road to Damascus. And you know something behind that beat down? He lost his eyesight. Ananias and Sapphira had to take him in. That's why he went into the teachings of Aquila and Priscilla. This man had a magnet life. That's why God took a terrorist and turned him into a triumphant warrior, the second chief apostle in charge. And see, apostle, let me get this right. Let me explain this to you. God delegated apostles to be commissioners. They were the actual commissioners of God. See, there's callings, there's elections or offices, and there's true callings. Now, apostles have to be called. Number one, man cannot make apostles. Let's get that right. Apostles come from God. Why? Because within them is encoded, spiritually encoded, a specific gift, a specific anointing to carry out a certain task that requires spiritual intervention. You see what I'm saying? So man cannot give you the ability of spiritual intervention. That's right. God can only equip you and anoint you and appoint you in that way. So this is the reason why we cannot lay hands on other people and say, I hereby give unto you the position of apostle. That's disrespectful. You can't do that. That's God's posture, God's delegation to bring forth an apostle. That's right. And understand that. And we've got people that have fallen out of grace to disgrace because they're doing it in various prestigious indeed organizations that are doing this. And it's disrespect to God. God knows what he's doing. And you can't do what God does, and you never will be able to, and you need to get over that. I don't care who you are, and what you say you represent. But let me tell you something. Apostle Paul set the house in order. That's right. There were 12 apostles, and ladies out there, and I'm just being respectful as being a teacher. Many of you refer to me as an evangelist, and I've even had a woman that referred to me as pastor. No, I'm not a pastor. No, I am an educator. I am a teacher. I was called to teach as a child. I've been teaching since I was a child. How many children do you know can master reading and writing at the age of 3? That was the gift of God that abided within me long before I knew anything about the manifestation of the things of God in the kingdom of heaven. But see, these things are embedded within us. But as we begin to experience life, sometimes we can become turbulent. We can become terse, and we ignore what God is saying to us. And then we suffer for it. Oh, yeah, he beats us down. He chases us with the broom. He slips us up, lets us fall, but he does not let us be destroyed. Then in his loving kindness and tender mercy, he raises us back up. So this is what it is. God has designated structure in his body. Why? Because there has to be order. God is a very intelligent God. He is a superior intelligent God. There is no knowledge. Einstein, Socrates, Aristotle, there is no philosopher that can out-philosophize God. Understand that. There is no greater mind than his. Because don't forget, he framed the universe. He created you and I, his spirit children. But now we are within a fleshly shell. At first we were spirit children without any limitation. See, when you have a body, you have limitations. You can only be in one place and at one time. We are called finite beings. He made us finite beings. Why? Because he had to have someone to act as custodial people, as you have custodians of the building who manage the upkeep of the establishment. Why? So it doesn't get dirty, it doesn't become defamed, it is not undesirable, so that they can provide structure. That's right. So he trusted us as custodians of his grace upon this earth. That's why we're here. And I don't care how and who our families were, if it was not God's will we were here, trust me to tell you, he does not make mistakes. He corrects the ones that we make. We wouldn't be here. But we're here for a purpose. That's right. And so, therefore, God is a God of structure. And what has happened is that the church has, in the terminology of speaking, I'm not talking about the church of Jesus Christ, is perfect. He is perfect. There's no flaw there. The flaw is within the extension of the church, which is us. We've flawed. We've gotten off course. We've gotten off track. And we've copped out and sold out because we want to be like these people we see on television because we're so dissatisfied and dysfunctional with our lives. We hide through the lives and the existence and behaviors of other people. Let me tell you something. I don't have any heroes. I don't have any idols. The only admiration I have is for the Lord God who made me and for Jesus Christ and the heavenly host. I look up to no man, no woman. And this is the idolatry faith that people go to with, because why? They don't want to stretch out in faith. They're too lazy in their own consciousness to believe God, stretch out in faith, and believe for the impossible, so they live through other people. That's why this world has gone to hell. And you don't like it, but so what? You can't do anything about it unless you start with yourself. That's right. So I don't care about offending people anymore because, you know, I'm responsible for what I teach and what I project at the end of the day. And you know something? I take your existence, your participation, as something very, very serious, okay? So Apostle Paul, again, had to set things in divine order because there was some turbulence at that day and time. People were doing what they wanted to do. Women were taking authority places that were not given to them. There were men who were sitting down and acting like the women should have been acting. So Apostle Paul just got sick and tired, and he had to address Timothy. Apostle Paul was more like a father figure to Timothy. Titus was a little older than Timothy was. Timothy was the youngest and the more virile of the apostles, and so he didn't know certain things, and so he was being very, very unassuming. That's right. He was unassuming. But at the same time, he wanted to do a work for God, and Timothy had a lot of passion. He was very fiery, very good speaker, but he still lacked that experience, and so Apostle Paul had to go to him. And in his first letter to him in the third chapter, he was setting him straight about the authoritative measure of the church setting on the earthly terminology of things, because I heard something that was presented last week. They have this new series. I'm not going to call the name of the series, and this woman said that she is the first bishop, African-American bishop. My ears literally just went up like little antennas. That's right. And I said, wait a minute. There's an inflection with that. Wait a minute. I need to come up with something that is clarative of this. And I began to research. You know, I've studied the scriptures numerous times, and I've done so for over the last fragmentation of 37, 38 years. But I had to come back into complacency with that. I says, wait a minute, that doesn't sound correct. Now, let me tell you something. I am a woman of great influence. I have been blessed and privileged in the area of leadership. Led many successful endeavors and yet doing it. Have had many speaking engagements and have many more coming up. But let me tell you something. There is a place, a compartment, that God has placed us as women in that is just totally stupendous. You know, the way that the Spirit of the Lord works through us and with us to do things, I'm just awed and inspired. I even think about how Mary and Martha were the first women to carry the gospel message. The other disciples, they had still been disciples, wondering what was going on. They never would have received the fullness of the promise of God of apostleship had not Mary and Martha not been at the sepulchre, waiting for the resurrection of our Messiah, Jesus Christ. These women carried the word to the disciples. Do you get me? Because the angel gave them the word. So the angels speak to us as women. And as women, the Holy Spirit deals with us. And we speak truth. We pronounce truth. We prophesy. We teach. We instruct. We encourage. We exhort. We counsel. Because God has given us as women that spiritually genetic encoding mechanism that a man does not have. And you know what that is, maybe you might not like it, but it's true compassion and nurturing as well as spiritual mothering. We're mothers. Even some of the greatest women I've seen to be mothers didn't even have any biological children, but they have that embedded with them. So us having children does not make us have that mothering and nurturing instinct. It is just embedded in us as women. Because why? This earth needs nurturing. It needs cultivation, and women can do that. Men provide the muscle and the strong arms, but we as women provide the nurturing, the compassion to get the process and to get the ball rolling. And this is why that is so very crucial, mental, and important to understand these things. And so God has put us in a very favorable position as women. Look at the prophetesses, Miriam. That's right. Look at Prophetess Deborah. That's right. How Miriam, she played the tambourine. Deborah was a judge. She was in a position of authority where she actually helped to facilitate the very elements of the children of Israel when they were in the land of the wilderness. That's right. So look at Miriam. Look at Rahab. Many people look at Rahab, say she was nothing but a whore. But let me tell you something. Rahab helped to protect the prophets. And as a result of her diligence and her action, God had mercy upon her and accepted her into the kingdom because of her diligence, because of her works. That's right. She was blessed. Look at New Testament women. That's right. Look at Dorcas or Tabitha. She was a seller of purple, which means she was a seamstress. She blessed so many people with beautiful, beautiful garments. She actually clothed people that didn't have anything to wear. That's right. She ministered to them. That's right. So look at her great works. Many of them call her Dorcas, and they call the young women to get the training Dorcas workers. That's right. So Tabitha was a great woman. Look at Lydia. Lydia also was a very prominent woman, very well-educated, very respected, who had a great influence upon the apostles. That's right. Look at Priscilla, the wife of Aquila, who helped to teach and instruct the apostles. She assisted her husband in that teaching process. That's right. She actually did. So think about those things. Aquila and Priscilla, Ananias and Sapphira. That's right. I know that many of you think about, oh, no, they fell victim to their own greed. Yeah, because their flesh got in the way of the will of God. But they were very instructional and influential teachers. That's right. Her husband led, and she followed and supported and gave her guiding parameters. So there's a lot of powerful women in the Bible. We talked about Mary and Martha. They both carried the word because Mary carried on Messiah and Martha carried John the Baptist. That's right. And then after the insurrection, the resurrection of our Messiah, they carried the gospel to the disciples that he has risen. So women have a very powerful and postured position in the Lord, and I'm grateful to that. But let me tell you something. Bishop, sister, I love you, and I love all women in the name of the Lord. I regard them as my sisters. But you are out of your place. And I'm going to give you scriptural referendum. And to those of you who say, oh, it's okay for a woman to have that position, according to scripture, in man's eyes, yeah, a person can have that position, but ask yourself, is this the will of God? And when you get out of place with God, God is not going to allow things to fall in place with you. Okay, it's just that simple. 1 Timothy, the 3rd chapter, the 1st verse. Let's read this. And I want you to go there yourself. I have the King James Version. I don't know whatever version you have. You still get the same reflective message. And it says, this is a true saying. This is Apostle Paul now. He's a commissioner of the first church. That's right. He's getting his permission and his authoritative measure and his vision from God. Apostles had nothing else to depend on but the Spirit of God, which is the Holy Spirit. This is a true saying. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good work. Uh-oh. Let's read that again. Ladies out there, you're in the wrong place, in the wrong station, wrong location. Let's get it right. This is a true saying. That means this is a relevant fact. A true saying is a fact. It's not fiction. He said, if man, not bald man, but if a M-A-N man desires, when you desire something, you want. You feel an urging to do. So if a man feels the urge or the calling, okay, the office of a bishop, what is a bishop? A bishop is the head of the congregations. That's right. A bishop is considered as a person that is the head of congregations. Some people say, does bishop mean pastor? In some aspects, it does. But primarily, when you think of bishop, he is an overseer of pastors. Do you get the pronunciation of this? He is an overseer of pastors, okay? He oversees the operations of other pastors. This, the pastoralship is another level. That's when you're the groundwork of being over a set congregation. Bishop is over, an overseer of pastors. More people think of the evaluation and the chief evaluator. So many people presume that the office of bishop is as a chief overseer or chief evaluator. He desired a good thing. He didn't say she. Apostle Paul was very specific. He didn't say she desires a good thing. He desires a good thing. That means if a man desires to be the overseer of the operations of other churches and pastors and be in that office, an office is something that's opted to the person, their experience, their commitment, and their willingness to do. That's right. Is bishopship a calling? It's not necessarily a calling. It's an office. It's an officiation. When I say office, you have to be delegated or nominated, then you have to be elected. So you get elected into office. You don't just walk in there and say, guess what, I'm the CEO of this company. No, you have to go through a process. That's right, in order to get there. So when you're delegated to be an overseer of other pastors, other congregations, that's a good thing to do because every congregation has a leader, and every leader needs mentoring, and that bishop is that mentor. Now, Apostle Paul said in his pretentiousness, as some people say, they get mad. I use the term pretentiousness as a way of not sarcasm, but just showing a point that he suffered the woman not to teach or to usurp the authority of a man. No. Apostle Paul wasn't saying women can't teach, women cannot minister. He's saying that a woman is not to take authority that is not in the posture of what God has set up as kingly manner upon this earth. Why? Because you're reversing the polarity of divine order. And when you reverse the polarity of God's divine order, you're going to have ultimate chaos. Let's go through it. The head of the universe is God. Jesus Christ is the head of mankind, the only begotten Son of God. And then under Jesus Christ is man. Under man is woman. So when a woman takes the office of a bishop, she is putting herself ahead of the man. Then before her is then Jesus Christ and then God. You can't reverse divine order. That's disorder. That brings about chaos. You're going to confuse a lot of people. You're going to knock a lot of people off tandem. You can't do it. The office of a bishop is next to the apostle. There were no women apostles. I'm sorry. There were no women apostles on the record. Women can go about calling themselves apostles. That's what they delegate to do. But according to God's eyes, it is not so. So we have to do things specifically and in order. Second, you want to know some other qualifications of a overseer of congregations or as a leader of pastors? Listen to this. A bishop then must be blameless. That means a person that is not capable of having a bad reputation. He has to have a good reputation, an honorable reputation. He does what he said he's going to do and conducts his affairs with discretion. And most important, listen to this, ladies and gentlemen, the husband of one wife. So in order to be delegated into the position of bishop, he not she, must be the husband of one wife. That means that he can't have a side interest. He can't have a previous wife that's still alive. And I know we compromise a whole lot of things because we say, oh, that was in the past. No. According to Scripture, he has to be the husband of one wife. Now, if his wife has went and decided to separate herself from him and because she felt that it was not in her best interest to stay with him and she marries another, then so be it. But if she's alive and well and he divorces her, he does not qualify to be a bishop. I don't care who gets offended. The truth is going to offend some, but to bring others to the next level of justification and cleanliness and sanctification and things that are wholesome and good. This is the reason why we can't get the supernatural flow of miracles going. There's too much bunk and junk going on in congregations, going on in structured organizations and offices. We got to clean this mess up because God is not pleased. So he has to be the husband of one wife. It is saying, ladies out there, the wife of one husband, he, not she. The husband of one wife. That cancels out women in the office of bishop. Vigilant. When a person is vigilant, they're quick to respond. You don't have to call them 20 times and tell them that you need to counsel with them as a pastor. They're quick. They're apt to respond to you. Sober. That means their head is on straight. They know what their responsibilities are, and they're going to take care of business. A good behavior. That means they know how to conduct themselves in the midst of when things are favorable and when they're unfavorable. Given to hospitality. What does that mean? A man that's an overseer of pastors, an overseer of congregations, he's willing to open up his doors. If they say they want to do something to help the foreign mission or help a certain family, he opens his doors and says, how quickly do you need it done? And ask to teach. One qualification that a bishop has to have, he may not always have to preach to other pastors and other congregations. But he has to be willing to teach, to instruct, not just so much in teach by the words that he speaks, but teach by his example, by his wisdom. So a bishop is to be a man of years, a man of experience. You only gain experience when you've had some tracks behind your tears, when you gain those years. So this is what a bishop is to do. He's like the father of the leaders of the congregations, okay? So he has to be quick to teach. Third verse of 1 Timothy 3rd chapter, not given to wine. They didn't say not given to much wine. That means he said not given to wine. That means not only the liquid libation, or what we refer to as wine. That means that he's not a person that's all about just having a good time. First thing we think about, oh, wine to my drink. It is always the constituency to just drinking wine. It means in the mannerism of always seeking pleasures, always wanting to go on trips, always wanting to go on cruises and do things for himself and his family. He's not given much to pleasure. He takes his office very seriously because at any given time, a pastor may need his assistance. There may be a specific issue in a congregation that the bishop has to go and to address because he's given account to God, okay? Nor striker. What is a striker? Quick to talk something down. Oh, no, that'll never work. Oh, you want to do this? No, that's foolish. No, he's not a striker. He's open-minded. He has an open heart, and he's willing to hear others out. Not greedy of filthy lucre. What does that mean? He's not willing to do anything and everything to get money and to live a lavish lifestyle at the expense of others while other people are suffering. He's not willing to say, get what I can get and forget the rest. He's not telling the congregational leaders, the pastors, to make financial reports to him so that he can get paid. He's not demanding money from the organization to sustain his lifestyle. He is a man that's willing to roll up his sleeves in his office and to work, but he receives the generosity of others and does not take their generosity lightly. So he's not willing to do any and everything to get money out of people. That means being greedy or filthy lucre, hard up for money. You look at some of these organizations, that like the song the OJs sing, money, 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 money. Everything is based upon money. Annual reports, semi-annual reports, missionary reports. That's a bunch of garbage that God is not pleased with, and God is cleaning up the garbage, and he's going to continue to do so. Trust me to tell you that. And you're going to see a whole lot of things moving in the way of cleaning things out, because these people have gotten over for far too long. Also, listen to this, but patient. When a person is patient, they're willing to listen to others and then give them the strong points without compromise. Not a brawler. I mean, quick to fight or quick to say, you know something, I'm going to have you removed as the pastor. I don't feel that you belong in this organization. No, he's not brawling. He's not willing to ball up his fist and just shake it in someone's face. He's patient. He's not covetous. He's not looking at who's got a mega church in this area and tried to get his pastors to compete with them. No, a bishop says, we're going to do what thus saith the Lord, and we're going to walk according to his will, his word, because this is what God has commanded of us. He is an elder. A bishop is a wise, wise sage. Okay? Fourth verse, one that ruleth well his own house. I mean, his own household is in order. Having his children under subjection with all gravity. What does that mean in the fourth verse? He is one who has his children to acknowledge the fact that, you know something, you have to be an example. An example not only to yourself, but to others. That he's not going to allow stupidity and foolishness in his house. Right. He didn't say she's not going to allow stupidity in her house. He said he's not going to allow stupidity in his house. Because why? The desire is the office of a bishop. If a man, back to the key verse, 1 Timothy 3:1, there is a true saying, if a man desires the office, a man, not a woman, desires the office of a bishop, he desires a good thing. Okay? That's the reason why he has to do it. For if a man in the fifth verse knoweth not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? Now, you see that? He didn't say she. But he says, for if a man, not woman, know not how to rule his own house, not her house, but his house, how shall he take care of the church of God? What's Apostle Paul saying? If a man cannot hold in subjection his household and cannot treat his wife with respect and do what is needful and necessary in his own domain, how can he kill other pastors? How to lead their congregations? How to love and treat their wives? How to help their children, how to nurture to the needs and necessities of believers. He's unqualified. That is one qualification that has to be a stipulation. It has to be a standard. A bishop, a leader of congregations, an overseer of congregational leaders, has to have a household that's ideal to the fact of honoring God. It has to be in perspective order. Why? Sixth verse, not a novice. That means not a young man, not a newcomer. I know some people say, I'm an ancient newcomer. No, you have to be experienced in years. That's right. You have to have lived in order to experience. So he can't be a newcomer, a man that's too young. Because what happens when a man is too young? Let's be realistic in the physical hemisphere of things. Let's just bring it down. When a man is too young, he is too operative upon testosterone. He's more apt to be wiry. He's more apt to be confrontational. He's more apt to be zealous. And see, as King David said, as it is written, the zeal of my own house has consumed me. That means my own fervor, my own desire, my own passions have overtaken me and caused me to make bad decisions. When men are younger, they are reckless. So having all this authoritative measure with a young man, look at the previous annunciation in the secular setting of what happened with the mayor of the city of Detroit, one of the most intelligent, influential young men ever. What happened? All that power, all that domain got to his head, and he started making reckless and bad decisions. Well, in the spiritual apparatus, don't forget, we're not so above and beyond the bar we can't fall. When a man is too young and too inexperienced, he can't face temptations in the office of a bishop. Because while his flesh will overwhelm him, he'll start looking at the attractive women that are coming in, and his wife and he are not getting along that good. He'll fall victim to his own flesh. The testosterone terrorist will rise up, and then he'll make reckless decisions and break up his household. When he's too young, he's not experienced enough to know how to control his emotions when it comes to brawling and being confrontational. And as a result of his lack of experience, a young man will be more prone to run a raging fist and become physically advantageous and confrontational when a situation arises. This is the reason why he can't be a novice. You can't be young in this office. He says, lest being lifted up in pride, because he pride goeth for destruction, and the Holy Spirit before a fall. And lest he fall into the condemnation of the devil. That means that he give place to the enemy to attack him. This is the reason why a man that's a bishop has to be a man of age, integrity, and experience, so that he'll know how to conduct himself. He'll be well-versed and well-rounded. We're going to come back with part two of this message on tomorrow. Yes, by way of request. We're coming back tomorrow. Check the time and the listing for tomorrow as we come back with this word of knowledge that's going to build us up on our most holy faith. And I say to you, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, for God is able to do exceedingly and abundantly above all we're able to ask and even think. You've got your host with the most from Coast to Coast, the Esquire, Abby A. Phelps, saying that in all things give thanks, for this is the will of God.